This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's great to have you with us on our Main Street today. Our conversation today will begin with Dr. Donald Warren. He was recently named Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences and the Director of UND's Indians into Medicine program. Today, we'll share a conversation with Dr. Warren that was produced by Community Health Center Incorporated, a nonprofit provider that serves Connecticut. The show is called Conversations on Healthcare, and it's hosted by Mark Maselli, the president and CEO of Community Health Center, and Margaret Flinter, a senior vice president at the center and a family nurse practitioner.
Dr. Warren, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, and as a primary care practitioner who comes from a long line of traditional healers in the Lakota and Oglala tribe, your experience growing up on the reservation exposed you to this time-honored tradition of healing practices, but also to the daunting challenges faced by the entire communities who were marginalized and cut off from access to economic mobility and good health care. And as you entered the medical profession, you were disheartened that so much of the disease burden you faced was largely preventable. I wonder if you could help our listeners understand the prevalence of disease and poor health in American Indian populations and why they're so challenging to address.
Sure. A lot of our issues that we face in health status are rooted in poverty and marginalization and less access to basic needs in life, like good education and good food and economic opportunities. So when we look at this from a historical perspective, of course, there's been a long history of marginalization and loss of land and loss of resources. And one of the outcomes of that is less access to services, less access to even simple things like healthy food. So quite often, our people are suffering from terrible disparities related to that, including much higher rates of type 2 diabetes and its related conditions, including heart disease. We also tend to see higher rates of cancer and other chronic diseases. But unfortunately, it doesn't end there. We also have other high rates of public health issues, like even unintentional injuries and accidents. We have very high rates of death among our young people due to motor vehicle accidents, but also higher infant mortality rates. So kind of across the whole spectrum, we're dealing with disparities in maternal and child health, early child health, and then chronic disease as people get older. So one of the outcomes is that our average age at death is much younger for American Indians. In North Dakota, the average age at death for American Indians is about 54 years. Mm. So it's just remarkably low lifespan.
Well, Dr. Warren, I'd like to try and put it a little bit into perspective, the American Indian health narrative, into a historical context. We have to look at the foundations of the current state of disparity in Native populations that you've just described, populations whose numbers have dwindled from a high of 25 million prior to the European migration down to just a few million today. And those Native people who survived the genocide of the American Indian, the Trail of Tears, brought that collective suffering with them and have carried it over these generations. Can you talk a little bit with us about the importance of understanding the role of epigenetics and cultural trauma and the impact that that has had on American Indian health?
Sure. And actually, just looking at the historical numbers of indigenous peoples in the Americas and relative to the numbers today, that doesn't really tell the whole story. So when we look at estimates of the indigenous population for North America and South America, it was in the 20 to 25 million range prior to contact with Europeans. And of that number, it's estimated that probably about 5 million lived in what is now the United States. We have to remember that the Americas are divided up into nations that were imposed on us from Europe, not necessarily part of our own perspectives in terms of differences between what is now Canada, U.S., and Mexico. So historically, there were probably about 5 million American Indians and Alaskan Natives in what is now the United States. And by 1900, that number was actually down to less than 200,000. Mm. So from over 5 million to less than 200,000. So that was almost a complete genocide. So when we look at the numbers now, with the 2010 census, there were about 5.2 million self-identified American Indians and Alaskan Natives in the census. So our numbers have rebounded in terms of the numbers of people. but huge impact in terms of historical trauma mm-hmm. and community-wide trauma and loss of culture, loss of resources, loss of people between initial contact and 1900. So we've seen our numbers rebound in terms of the numbers of people, but the impact is there in terms of historical trauma. And there is emerging scientific evidence in the field of epigenetics mm-hmm. that shows that when populations undergo significant toxic stress and traumas, it can have intergenerational impact on gene expression and potentially direct impact on poor health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was taken by longevity being in the mid-50s and certainly impacted by diabetes, depression, and alcoholism. And, you know, you've talked about the Western medicine approach to this, which are to split these conditions apart and then also split apart the medical side from the behavioral health. And really, you come at it from a different vantage point, looking at it more holistically and also in a cultural context for the American Indian population. I'm wondering if you could tell us more about that and also tell us about your medicine wheel approach as well.
Sure. When I was working as a full-time primary care physician, it was in Arizona and with one of the tribal populations that's really devastated by diabetes. Mm-hmm. In some of our populations, half the adults have type 2 diabetes. It really is a remarkable disparity that we see right in Indian country, right in the middle of this nation. And what I see among many people with diabetes, whether they're American Indian or not, is high rates of depression. Mm-hmm. It's actually so prevalent, I think we should be considering depression a complication of diabetes mm-hmm. because it mm-hmm. is so common. Now, not everyone with diabetes gets depression, but not everyone with diabetes gets kidney failure either. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think depression's common enough, it really should be considered a complication. And in this nation, whether you're American Indian or not, the most common self-medication for depression is alcohol intake. Mm-hmm. So what I see is a lot of people with diabetes who are self-medicating their depression with alcohol intake, and the alcohol intake actually makes the blood sugar worse and makes the depression worse, which leads to even more alcohol intake. So I see this vicious cycle of diabetes, depression, and alcohol intake. And it really is a syndrome. I've seen it in hundreds of patients and in thousands of patient visits. But we don't treat it systemically or holistically. Mm-hmm. We treat each individual condition individually. And we tend to look at diabetes management and outpatient depression management as a medical issue. But if someone has major depression and alcohol dependence that requires treatment, then we see that as a behavioral health issue. Yes. So we essentially cut the patient in half and say that the medical side will do its part, the behavioral health side will do its part, but we don't really collectively meet and address this from a holistic perspective. And that's very contrary to what we would do traditionally. And what I was taught in traditional Lakota approaches to health, and certainly other tribes have consistent approaches as well, is that we would never look at this in just individual parts. We'd look at the whole and recognize it holistically. What's happening here is there's certainly physical illness, but there's also emotional, spiritual, and mental imbalance that needs to be addressed. So if we were to be intelligent as a health system, mm-hmm. we would address it from the perspective of how the patient is experiencing the disease processes, but we're not very good at that in modern medicine. And I think that's one area where traditional medicine has much to teach us in mm-hmm. modern scientific medicine.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Warren, looking back a ways, I know that you were being considered by the previous administration for the post of U.S. Surgeon General. And had you been chosen, you said you would have used that platform as a chance to highlight the underfunded and under-resourced Indian Health Service, which has suffered from decades of neglect. The current administration has stated publicly that they'd like to see even more cuts to the Indian Health Services, as well as cuts to the Medicaid expansion, which you've noted is the single most effective policy in decades to advance the health of the American Indian population. Talk with us about the challenges within the Indian Health Services, and I think you have to start maybe with a just quick overview for our listeners, and what solutions you envision to address this significant gap in resources, and sort of your thoughts on the degree to which the Indian Health Service is embracing this model of a fully holistic approach that integrates the traditional and the Western, the emotional, the spiritual, and the physical needs of its patients.
Yeah, the history of health law and policy for American Indians is very complex. In the United States, people are not born with a legal right to health services. And that's true for everyone except American Indians. We're actually the only population born with a legal right to health services. And that's based on the many hundreds of treaties that were signed between tribal nations and the federal government. And essentially, the tribes exchanged land and natural resources for various social services like health, education, and housing. So that's why there's a Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's why there's a Bureau of Indian Education. That's why there's an Indian Health Service. Those are the federal agencies that are responsible for carrying out the federal government's trust responsibility to American Indians. So the land that is now the United States was not lost in a war. It was actually exchanged through treaties. And treaties are the highest order of law in the land. There's even a treaty clause in the U.S. Constitution that states that treaties are the highest order of law. So we have hundreds and hundreds of treaties between tribal nations and the federal government. And most of the treaties have some sort of component of health care included. Some of the common language was promise of all proper care and protection. And certainly, as American Indians, we have not received all proper care and protection. So in a very basic way, if you look at these treaties as contracts between tribal nations and the U.S. government is in breach of contract because they have not held up their end of the bargain in terms of funding health programs. So Indian Health Service, for many, many decades now, has been funded at about 40 to 50% of actual need. So we have inadequate resources to provide all proper care and protection as lined out in our treaties. And one of the programs that did help a lot is Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Of course, not every state expanded Medicaid. Mm-hmm. But if you look at access to health services comparing North Dakota and South Dakota, where North Dakota we expanded Medicaid, South Dakota we did not, we have much better access to health services and resources in Medicaid expansion states like North Dakota. I think Indian Health Service does its best with its limited resources to try to address things holistically. Even their mission looks at building emotional and spiritual health to the highest level possible. The challenge is we just don't have the resources to fully invest in protecting health of American Indians. And that really is the fault of Congress. And Congress is quick to point the finger at IHS for mismanagement or, or being inept at providing services, but they should be pointing the fingers at themselves for underfunding this whole program for now for decades.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Today we're sharing a conversation with Dr. Donald Warren, the new director of the Indians into Medicine program at UND. It was produced by Community Health Center, a nonprofit that champions health care for underserved populations. We'll have more of this conversation with Dr. Donald Warren in just a moment.
You've heard of speed dating, right? Well, we have something akin to that. It's ASCA, Prairie Public's new initiative that aims to break down barriers and facilitate meaningful conversation and a deeper understanding. Here it is. Get eight people from a group that's in the news and find eight other sincerely curious folks who want to know more about them. We hope to spur lively one-on-one and group discussions and make connections with others in our communities. We'll interview participants for radio features that will be broadcast on Prairie Public so the conversations can have real statewide impact. Interested? We're looking for askers and answerers for our first ASCA chat, Ask a Native American, August 11th at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. You can sign up now or find out more at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And today we're sharing a conversation with Dr. Donald Warren, the new director of the Indians into Medicine program at UND. It was produced by Community Health Center, a nonprofit that champions health care for underserved populations in Connecticut. Here's that conversation.
Dr. Warren, we recently had North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum on the show talking about the state's effort to confront addiction. And significantly, it impacts the American Indian population. And you participated in the Governor's Day of Prevention. And you said, to get to solutions to our addiction dilemma, you have to walk through truth. Tell us more about walking through truth and some of the public health partnerships that are needed to help the American Indian communities get the help they desperately need.
Well, some of the truth that we need to contend with is that as a nation, we need to come to terms with the American Holocaust, and that's exactly what it was. And the American Indian population was almost completely wiped out. And some of the tribes have completely disappeared because of deliberate efforts to kill American Indians. And the challenge there is that we don't see a lot of this in our history books because it's unpleasant. Mm-hmm. But if we are ever going to get to health equity, where we can actually raise health to appropriate status for every population, we have to contend with the truth. And I see a reluctance to do that because it makes people feel bad. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, there was deliberate attempt at genocide of American Indians. People may have heard of Amherst, Massachusetts, or Amherst College. Mm-hmm. It's named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who was a colonial governor in the colonies. And he is the one who ordered the distribution of blankets from a smallpox hospital to the northeastern tribes with the purpose of killing them. So our first documented case of bioterrorism is our own colonial government. Yeah. But that's not taught in our history books. It's remarkable how often I share that story and people are in shock, had no idea. Mm-hmm. But that's a part of our truth. And I think that if we don't understand the truth of history, what I see is that people blame the victims. They don't understand why we have such high rates of poverty. They don't understand why we have such high rates of addiction or high rates of diabetes or cancer. Well, there are reasons for this, but they are unpleasant reasons. And what I see is a reluctance to embrace the truth because people don't like it. Well, from my perspective, if you want to get to equity, you have to walk through truth, even when it's unpleasant. In terms of partnerships, we do have to work with not just the federal government, but also with our states, with Medicaid programs, with private sector agencies. And one of our challenges historically is that we have smaller numbers than other populations. We are the minority of the minority populations, and we are very underrepresented in leadership positions and in policymaking positions. As an example, the Congressional Black Caucus is comprised of primarily African Americans. For American Indians, there's nobody in the Senate, for example. We have zero American Indian senators. So at the highest level of lawmaking and policymaking, we're underrepresented. So we have to have partnerships with non-Indian populations to improve policymaking and lawmaking around access to health services. So that's something we're working on. There's a lot of national and regional agencies that are trying to improve this. But I think one of our challenges, again, with the lack of appropriate and accurate truth-telling in history, most people are unaware of these issues. So we're kind of out of sight, out of mind, and that's adding to the disparity.
Well, Dr. Warren, I really appreciate that you're tackling health inequities in one way by developing programs that enhance public health best practices with culturally relevant strategies. You're building a curriculum around that at the North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. You're encouraging through InMed American Indians to pursue careers in the health professions so they can advance their own careers, but also care for their home communities and significantly impact population health within their tribes. Talk with us about your approach to training the next generation of healthcare providers, physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, midwives, PAs, healers in the American Indian community. And what's unique about your approach and what are you seeing in terms of success?
Well, it's a significant challenge because when we want to build the next generation of health professionals, we have to recognize we have a limited pool because of high rates of high school dropout. Yep. So much of our work is also focused on building the pipeline of potential future health leaders from our communities, because if we have less high school graduates, we'll have less college students and therefore less potential medical students. So we're working on building the pipeline. Actually, right now we have our InMed Summer Institute going on. We have currently 45 students from across the nation who are American Indian high school and middle school students here at University of North Dakota for 6 weeks. And we expose them to all kinds of opportunities in health careers, and they get to actually have a cohort of colleagues who are from similar backgrounds. Even if they had never met before, they get to come together and realize that they're not the only ones who are American Indian who are interested in health careers. Right. So there's a lot of power in having cohorts of people or groups of people that are trying to work toward a similar goal. I think if you're from the majority population, you don't really recognize the impact of role models, because if you grow up and all of your teachers, all of your doctors that you've ever seen are from your race, then anything seems possible. You know, it wasn't until I was in college until I finally met an American Indian physician. And the disparities and the shortages of American Indian health professionals are just tremendous. So that's really part of my goal now, is to try to reverse that. Another one of our challenges is that we don't have enough American Indian medical faculty members. Around the nation, the Association of American Medical Colleges does keep track of race and ethnicity for faculty members. And there's different ranking of professors in medicine. In the United States, there are over 37,000 professors of medicine. Of that number, 10 are American Indian.
That's
10
powerful.
Out of 37,000. Yeah. So just the need for building role models and leaders within academic health institutions is just tremendous. I mean, the disparities are almost laughably ridiculous. So we're going to do our part to try to reverse that.
Well, we always also like to look on the other side, and in the public health community should keep an eye on. You clearly are a success story, but who do you look for as role models? It seems like the population has grown. Can I assume it's a younger population? How, in other ways, are you describing the successes to young American Indians who are looking for careers, looking to role models like yourself? Who else stands out, and what are you seeing that excites you about the population in terms of accomplishments that happen?
Yeah, we do have a very young population. In addition to high rates of death, we also have high rates of birth. So the result is we have a very young population of American Indians and Alaska Natives. And I'm very encouraged about this current generation. There seems to be a reawakening of cultural connectedness, but also this younger generation wanting to do more for their communities, much more social activism, much more inclusiveness. And another thing I find encouraging is that the younger generation of millennials here in the United States, I don't see the same degree of racism. I see much more acceptance. And I think this current generation that's now turning 18 is the most diverse generation that we've ever had in this nation. And this generation moving forward feels like it's much more tolerant of others than previous generations. So I feel good about the future. And what I'm hoping we can do is build upon that and recognize that as American Indians, but also as members of this nation, we should all be in this together. We should be working toward building equity for all populations. And I see a lot of that energy within our young students right now. I'm very encouraged about the future, and I believe that as the seventh generation of survivors from Wounded Knee and other terrible outcomes, I see hope for the future in their energy.
You know, Dr. Warren, I have to ask you a timely question, which is really about your knowledge and expertise and experience as then applied to what we need to learn for all people. And I wonder, given the historical experience of the separation of so many Native American families from their children as they were sent to boarding schools and the like, as you look at our current situation at the border with the separation of parents and children, whether you have any advice or comment for the country on the potential long-term impact of that?
Yeah, this is certainly a stark example of adverse childhood experiences, and we know that adverse childhood experiences correlate to poor health outcomes for adults.
Yeah.
So the worse the experiences are in childhood, the worse the health status is as people get older. And it's just remarkable to me that we're allowing this to happen. But again, it's an older generation of people who dehumanize others. And unfortunately, in this country, there's been a long history of that. But again, I don't think that the millennial generation is on board with the type of policymakers who would take children away from families. I don't think they're that hateful in the younger generation. But we have what we have right now, so we all need to collectively recognize that this is wrong. It's certainly, they try to quote the Bible, it's certainly not Christian. It's horrific circumstances, and we are going to harm that entire generation of children who are just simply seeking safety.
Dr. Warren, thank you so much for your work, your dedication to addressing health disparities, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
I appreciate being a part of the conversation.
Dr. Donald Warren is the new director of the Indians into Medicine program at the University of North Dakota. He was interviewed by Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, the hosts of Conversations on Healthcare, which was produced by Marianne O'Hare for Community Health Center Incorporated, a nonprofit based in Connecticut. You can hear more at chcradio.com. Coming up on Main Street, our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson, and a new movie review from Matt Olean.
I'm Cassie Shipley, Donor Relations Coordinator for Prairie Public. If you're a sustaining member, we can't thank you enough. Your generous monthly contribution provides a reliable source of funding so we can bring you high-quality programming and fact-based, independent journalism. Plus, you help bring down the costs of mailing out pledge reminders. And of course, it's greener for the environment. So we know you enjoy the little extra benefit of saving Prairie Public money. But here's where we could use your help again. Expired and renewed credit cards can stop a sustaining membership in its tracks. But that can't happen when you set up your monthly deduction via a checking account. So make the switch. All we need is your bank's routing number and your account number. That's it. So make your monthly gift to Prairie Public count even more by switching your sustaining membership to a checking account monthly deduction. It's easy to do. Just call me, Cassie Shipley, at 800-359-6900, extension 538, or email at sustainer@prairiepublic.org.
Well, as that old wire machine indicates, it's time to talk about the news with our news director, Dave Thompson. He joins us every Friday from our microphone in our Bismarck studio. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
The Supreme Court, according to a story you filed 20 hours ago, says states, local governments can require internet retailers to collect sales taxes. This has been a long, ongoing thing, hasn't it?
It sure has. Go back to 1992 to the original case, which was Quill versus North Dakota. Then Attorney General Heidi Heitkamp argued it before the U.S. Supreme Court at that time. And they were thinking internet retail is going to be a big thing, and they wanted to get ahead of it and make sure internet retailers are collecting state sales taxes. Well, the Supreme Court in that case said, nope, we don't want to stifle any growth of this new industry, which is internet sales. And they all said what we need to do is have Congress actually pass a law and take care of it that way. Well, the states waited for Congress to act. No act in Congress. Senate passed the bill a couple of times called the Internet Fairness Act. House did not take it up. Anyway, South Dakota is the one who passed this, the new law, and it's about Wayfair and some other retailers saying, okay, we need you to start collecting sales taxes. Well, it was ripe for the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, said, yes, you now have to start collecting state sales taxes.
So it reverses that Quill versus North Dakota decision.
It does. It does.
And it means more money for the state.
It does. And North Dakota could be somewhere between $25 and $50 million a year in lost sales tax revenues right now can be recaptured by forcing these retailers to collect sales taxes.
All right. And just as a side note here, we're going to have James Lyman, the new Senior Manager of Economic Development Initiatives at the North Dakota Commerce Department, on our show on Monday. And one of the things we'll talk about is the online trend in retail and what that might mean for Main Street retail.
Right. So. And, you know, there's been that whole thing about Main Street retention, or I should say Main Street, collapsing of some of the big retailers. You know, Sears is closing stores all over the country. Kmart has, and there are some other real estate retailers. Toys R Us is out of business.
Well, Herberger's is big in
this area. Herberger's is big in this business, and the whole Bon-Ton Stores, which is their parent company, is going out of business too.
So times are changing, and
it is.
Malls and downtowns are changing along with it.
Okay. They sure are.
Dave, you've also filed a story earlier this week that the anti-corruption measure backers have submitted petitions for an initiated constitutional measure. This is that sort of ethics commission idea that's been floated around the state?
That's correct. Ethics commission, there are a number of pillars there. For example, that if you are a lawmaker or an elected official, you have to wait 2 years before you go work for a lobbying firm, and there would be prohibition of some types of gifts from lobbyists to lawmakers. And there would also be a prohibition so that somebody could not use campaign donations for personal use. There are these things that are out there, and the organizers say the climate seems to be right for this type of measure.
Well, and of course, this type of measure has been talked about for a very long time. The legislature has been resistant, so now the end around the legislature to an initiated measure.
That's correct, and this would be a constitutional measure, and that gives some people a bit of gas, because if you put it in the Constitution, it's very, very hard to change. If you passed it as an initiated measure, well, then it'd be easier to make some changes, but if you put it in the Constitution, you know, 2/3 votes, so.
Okay, so they're looking for some insurance, I take it.
I think so.
Dave, you also filed a couple of stories this week about opioid lawsuits at the county level. The state of North Dakota is pursuing one, but Cass County and Burley County are looking at their own.
What sparked that is I happened to see something in a Burley County Commission agenda, decided to go to the commission, and this law firm from Dallas, Texas was presenting saying, we've got these cases brought by political subdivisions that are being consolidated into, I think it's in Ohio Federal District Court. And Cass County has had a couple of presentations from law firms as well, and they're considering whether or not this is the way to go rather than, you know, join the state in its lawsuit.
So is the state at odds with Cass and Burley counties?
Not necessarily at odds, but Cass and Burley both have some suspicions that if the state takes it on as one whole, they may not get their fair share of a settlement. And they point to the tobacco settlement, which none of it came back to the counties until the legislature stepped in.
Okay. Well, let's talk about water out there. It turns out that there's this embankment I've driven over it a few times.
Oh, yes.
That separates Lake Sakakawea from Lake Audubon. And you can notice the difference in levels on occasion, but I think they're particularly concerned about a major drawdown and how that might affect that embankment.
That's correct. If you've got too much of an imbalance between Lake Audubon and Lake Sakakawea, which happened in that drought in the late 1980s, there's some worry that there could be more erosion of that embankment and perhaps an embankment failure. Why do you want to prevent that? Well, you've got a four-lane highway. That's U.S. Highway 83, the main route between Minot and Bismarck, plus a very good route to Canada as well. You also carry a railroad tracks and some high-voltage power lines. So there is some concerns about if they have times of extreme drought, maybe you're going to have to do more to equalize the levels between the two lakes.
Okay. Well, we've had some rains across the state. River levels have come up. I don't think there's any dire danger of flooding, but I know the Red River at Fargo came up close to flood stage, and the Missouri
right.
River is rising too.
It is, and of course, that, a lot of that is the mountain snowpack.
Oh, that's
and also, you have the rains that were in Montana. Mm-hmm. They had some pretty good rains. Came up the Yellowstone and into the Missouri River system. So now you're talking about levels of 60,000 cubic feet per second being released from Garrison Dam today. Now, this is not close to the flood year where it was over 150,000 cubic feet per second.
Wow.
But there is concern because you've got that once burned, twice shy mentality because, you know, the river came up so far back in 11. And they want to prevent that from happening again.
Yeah, floods are awful things when
they
happen.
They are.
Dave, you had a story yesterday. Lincoln residents are being asked to boil drinking water. They found E. coli in one home.
In one home of almost 1,300 homes. And it tested twice for E. coli. So the health department said, don't take any chances. So if you wanted to drink that tap water, you had to boil it first. You could still use it for some things like, you know, bathing, washing your hands, things like that. But the concern is ingesting the stuff. Now, today, that boil order has been lifted because the problem has been corrected, and the latest tests do not show the E. coli.
Well, that's good news. Okay. We've been talking about this story, Dave, a bit. North Dakota suicides have increased mm-hmm. by 58% in a 17-year time frame. It ended
yes.
in 2016. North Dakota was way up there in terms of the rate increase.
That's right. We were one of the top in terms of the rate increase, a kind of a dubious distinction if you want. Now, there's all sorts of things. There are all sorts of promotions now about how somebody who might be thinking about suicide can get help. And one of the things that everybody says, if you find out that one of your friends is contemplating that or his or her mood might be off, maybe you want to get them in touch with some of these helplines. You know, First Lincoln Fargo, for example, has some suicide help as well.
And if you just Google First Link, you'll get that number. And it's mm-hmm. important to intervene if you see these kinds of signs. And again, Danielle Webster's story from earlier this week says that there are certain populations that have higher rates, older people in general.
Older people, that's right.
American Indian populations, veterans. And we've got lots of all of these people in North Dakota.
We certainly do. And, you know, the concern is there. And the numbers to me were a bit of an eye-opener.
Yeah,
in terms of the amount of increase.
And Ashley Thornburg's reminding me that we've also had these concerns about farmers because farm prices have been in a bad way for a while, and some farmers are feeling the stress, and farm suicides are up.
there was some worry about that in the late 1980s when we had that severe drought for a few years there, too.
Mm-hmm. And then, meanwhile, there is an anonymous suicide prevention tool to help law enforcement people in Cass County now. This is an interesting wrinkle.
A few years ago, a very popular Fargo cop committed suicide because of the stress of the job. Mm-hmm. And they're worried that as the jobs get more and more complicated with the growing population in and around the city areas, that, you know, the stresses level is going to go up for cops and give them a place to go where they can share some of their stress levels and maybe find some help and you don't have to identify yourself.
Yeah, they're in a job, in an occupation that provides plenty of stress. And that is a concern,
sure.
I think, for
that's
people
for sure.
in those helping occupations. The first West Nile human case was reported in North Dakota not many days ago, Dave.
Yeah, at least it was a mild case. The person was not hospitalized. But, you know, you always have that concern because West Nile takes many forms. The most serious form could be a lot of joint pain and some nausea and some headache and could lead to some serious complications. So people, you know, the health department is saying, be careful. The season is here. Culex tarsalis mosquitoes have been found in Williams County and in Grand Forks County, so they're worried about that too.
And if mosquitoes aren't enough to worry about, you've got ticks and Lyme disease as well. So.
And I can tell you from experience, I was up visiting some relatives who had stayed at Cross Ranch State Park. Oh, there are a lot of ticks. There are a lot of ticks out.
Well, I have a friend who's dealing with it right now, so that's why it was on my mind.
Lyme disease?
Yes.
Yes.
You mentioned there's a story this week that you filed, Dave, or earlier this week. Recycling is growing in North Dakota. That's encouraging to see.
It is. You've got more than a dozen cities right now who are actually doing proactive recycling. They're doing things like no sort recycling bins, or they're asking you to recycle different materials, you know, not just plastic bottles. That it is growing, you know, and you're seeing that in more of the population centers. But Dickinson has just got a new thing that's going to be rolled out this fall, where they're going to be doing that one source recycling too, where you have the one garbage bin that is only for recyclables.
Yeah, we've been using that around our part of the state for a while, and it seems to be working pretty well.
It does. Well, there are a lot of places that still you can take recyclings to a center.
Sure. Well, let's talk a bit about politics here. Mm-hmm. The ACA, the Obamacare, the health care issue that's been this political football for years now is still a political football. And we've got the House candidates in North Dakota, Max Schneider and Kelly Armstrong, are on different wavelengths about
they
this issue.
Certainly. And Kelly Armstrong is one repeal. He wants to repeal and replace it. Josh Boucher wants to protect at least, you know, the Medicare and Medicaid expansion to make sure that people who do not have insurance can be covered. It's a bit of a sticky wicket, and I know that the North Dakota Insurance Department is taking a look at how all this is going to fit together and how you make sure that people do have coverage available to them, and especially if you have pre-existing conditions, which has really been a concern of a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm thinking that Max Schneider is obviously putting this out there because he's the Democrat House candidate against Kelly Armstrong, and that this is something that is an issue. And
it
pre-existing
is.
Conditions, because the Justice Department has announced it's not going to pursue those cases, that's in play again, and that's going to probably invigorate this discussion a bit more.
It may, and I know that there's some added pressure going on members of Congress to come up with something that will replace it. And so far, Congress has failed to pass anything to replace it.
Okay. Well, to be continued.
Yes, it is.
Dave, you said that something that really intrigued me before we started our conversation today, that the next time we have a ballot in the state of North Dakota, there won't be any Libertarian candidates on it?
This year was very interesting because there was only one person identified as a Libertarian. That was Roland Reimers from Grand Forks, who wanted to run for Secretary of State. He was identified on the primary ballot as a Libertarian. Well, under state law, you have to get the same amount of amount of votes that you got signatures to get on the ballot. That was 300. He fell short. So he cannot run in the November election, and he cannot run, of course, as an independent or as a Libertarian. So the last Libertarian on North Dakota's ballot will not be on the ballot in November.
Well, that's interesting. Every Friday we talk with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Doug.
Coming up next, Madeline and Ashley Thornburg talk about a new movie.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
And now this from the Main Street Radio Show on Prairie Public.
Well, there's the fanfare. That means it is time for another movie review with our resident movie critic, Madeline. Matt, thanks as always for coming in. And you have seen First Reformed. I've seen one critic refer to Ethan Hawke, to this performance, as the part he was born to play.
Yeah, it's a tortured performance. It's his best work since Boyhood. Boyhood is probably his career defining performance, which was filmed over 12 years, as you well know. And he probably would have won the Oscar that year had it not been for J.K. Simmons, stealing the movie Whiplash. So we're kind of back to Taxi Driver territory here. Paul Schrader is the writer-director. Now, he was famously the screenwriter for Taxi Driver, the Martin Scorsese film from 1976. He's directed a lot of films since then, but he's been kind of on the fringes. 5 years ago, he infamously made a film called The Canyons with Lindsay Lohan and Triple X actor James Dean. Now, when you make a movie with Lindsay Lohan and a Triple X actor, you're probably working on the fringes. It was barely seen. It was awful. But here, he's got a good cast. Ethan Hawke, Amanda Seyfried is in it as well. And we're kind of back to the treatise of the man alone, Taxi Driver. There's also echoes of French film director Robert Bresson here with his films Diary of a Country Priest and Pickpocket. If people are familiar with him, they'll know what I'm talking about, or look him up before you go see the film. So Hawke plays a Protestant minister at a Dutch settlement tourist church in upstate New York. It's mostly a tourist church. People stop in to look at it because it was formed in the 1700s. He's got a very small group of people that do go there, including Amanda Seyfried and her husband, who's mentally troubled. He's an environmental activist. He thinks the world's going to end. He's very depressed. And she enlists him to kind of counsel her husband, try to get him out of his doldrums. Meanwhile, Hawke himself in the film has health problems. He's not getting them checked. Some of the parishioners at the bigger church that kind of oversees the settlement church are worried about him. We don't really know what's wrong with him, but he's clearly got some sort of illness. He's also got a past. We learn very quickly he's got a backstory that's a little bit tragic, involving a first marriage and a son, and people will find that out as well. So I don't want to give too much else away. That's just kind of the basic first 5-10 minutes, but he tries to counsel this man, and strange things happen from there and spiral out of control. And he's kind of faced with a moral dilemma. It's one of those moral dilemma films. What does he do? How does he act? Does he take seriously what this man is saying about the end of the world? Is there something that might be going on between Hawke and Amanda Seyfried as well? So it's a fascinating movie. I think it's one of the best movies of the year so far. The ending may have people scratching their heads a little bit, but I think after I slept on it, I figured out what that ending means. Mm. It's open to interpretation, but it's a very good film. Hawke really gives a tortured performance. You can see the life he's led on his face, the lines in his face. He's come a long way since his Boyhood performance in Dead Poets Society, and he really broke out of the pack of all the boys in that film to be the superstar that he is. And, last year he was in Maudie with Sally Hawkins, played a complete character role. You hardly recognized him. So he's really become a really phenomenal actor. Maybe this will be another Oscar nomination for him. Whether you are religious or not religious, I think people will find this film interesting because it's really about faith. What is faith? The struggle to have faith when things are not going your way. And what do you do when you're faced with crisis? So he's really this man alone who likes to be alone, but he's got a moral dilemma to face on what to do with Siegfried's husband and his problems, and then what to do about his own life and his health issues.
So is it a lot of shots where Ethan Hawke is the only person on screen for long stretches?
Sometimes he's alone. Mostly he lives in the rectory next to the church, and a lot of times he's drinking and kind of being alone and having in his thoughts. He writes a diary, too. The film starts with him announcing he's going to write a diary for a year and write down his thoughts. So that's kind of our linchpin narrative walking us through the film is his written words on paper and what he feels and what he thinks. But much of the time, too, he's talking to Amanda Seyfried and her husband. He's talking to the church parishioners. He's talking to the choir director, which is an interesting kind of relationship he has with her that becomes kind of an interesting part of the film as well. So it's his interactions with other people. He doesn't quite give of himself to people, too. He holds things back. People want him to be more open. So, yes, he is alone much of the time, but also we kind of see his torture through how he interacts with other people.
Is it a commentary film on climate change and on the religious community and the response to climate change?
Yes, good question. It certainly is. So as I said, Siegfried's husband is an environmental activist, very concerned about climate change. And Hawke's character has to wrestle with this. You know, how much should the church be involved in this? Is this something the church should be involved in this? Does he bring this to the pulpit? Does he talk to people about climate change? And he gets very, very mixed reactions from people based on what he decides to do with this information. So, yes, I did view it as such, as sort of an environmental call to arms with this film. It's not preachy about it, though. It's not really even the central part of the film. It's how he responds to it and what is his reaction going to be? What is he going to do? There are some interesting twists in this film, so you'll have to wait for those.
All right. Well,
I liked it a lot.
Ethan Hawke, you said, gave a tortured sort of tour de force performance. So my Oscar question is related to Ethan Hawke. He has been nominated for 4 Academy Awards. What are they?
So a supporting actor for Training Day, 2001, supporting actor for Boyhood in 2014. And I believe, Ashley, he has 2 screenwriting nominations with Richard Linklater and Julie Delpy for Before Sunrise. And then there's 3 of them Before Sunset.
Before Midnight and Before Sunset are the two that he got.
And they had script nominations.
Nominations for adapted screenplay. Yes. So we've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 22nd. North Dakota remembers World War I. E. H. Tostevin, the Mandan soldier and newspaper man, traveled throughout France attempting to record the war as seen through the eyes of North Dakota soldiers. In a hospital somewhere in France, he met Albert T. Mastrud, a freckled-faced 19-year-old from Hatton who fought near the town of Boresch, France, on this date in 1918. He was one of 16 North Dakota soldiers in his company from Barnes, Trail, and Cass counties, who had enlisted in the Marines in May of 1917, shortly after the United States entered the war. As they went into battle, only 2 of them were over 20 years of age. Assigned to take some machine gun positions, Mastrud stated that they didn't have time to think about danger. They just charged across no man's land and straight at the machine guns. "Yes, it takes guts to do it," Mastrud recalled, "this going up to a machine gun on a frontal attack. You see men dropping all around you, and you think you haven't got a chance anyway, and then you think, well, they haven't got me yet. Maybe I'll get by." And he surmised, "About that time, you get so boiling, dang, busted mad that you don't care what happens. Oh, well, you don't get much time for thinking." On one occasion, a high-explosive shell cut the shoulder strap of his pack and tore it off, but he kept on going. The next day, when he found it, he claimed that it contained an additional 50 pounds of shrapnel. Mastrud recalled the good feed that night after taking the town of Buresh. "We had been watching all day, and every once in a while we could hear them butchering cattle or pigs. The house I hit that night had a half a pig still roasting with the fire still going. That fresh meat and hot, just as though we had ordered it, sure tasted dang busted good." On June 26th, when the battle ended, the official casualty count for the Marines was over 300 dead, 700 wounded, with two missing. As for Albert Mastrud and the Marines from North Dakota, he said, "Just tell the folks for us that we intend to keep right on going until the Kaiser wishes he was enjoying the peace and quietude of hell. None of us would miss this for all the money in the state of North Dakota." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Monday on Main Street, James Lyman is the new Senior Manager of Economic Development Initiatives at the North Dakota Commerce Department. We'll learn about various economic development efforts, including intermodal transportation and workforce challenges that the state has. We'll also discuss the online trend in retail and what that might mean for Main Street retailers in the state. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.